You've heard of NAFTA and the WTO, but it's time to add another international trade organization to the list, this time one with a catchier name. Atlantica is a proposed regional free trade zone spanning the Atlantic provinces and the northeastern United States. Last Thursday, the Spring Garden Memorial Library in Halifax hosted Resisting Atlantica, a panel discussion on regional free trade and what it could mean for life in the Atlantic provinces. Here's Cliff White of the Council of Canadians with some background on what Atlantica is and how it fits into the North American free trade picture.
We wanted to start off talking a little bit about the broader context, because Atlantica fits within a broad range of activities that are being pursued by the Canadian government, the Canadian business community, the business elites anyway, and the American and to some extent the Mexican groups of the same ilk. And so I wanted to try to put the evening's discussion, give it a little context, just where Atlantica comes from. It didn't come out of the blue. They didn't suddenly have this bright idea a couple of weeks ago or a couple of months ago that they were going to do this. It really is in line with some of the other initiatives that are going on. I don't know how many here have heard of deep integration. It's a rather an awkward term. Yeah. A lot of people, but not everybody. At the council, we've tried to come up with something else. We haven't been very successful, but different groups have been calling it different things. The C.D. Howe Institute calls it the big idea. The Canadian Council for Chief Executives calls it reinventing the border. What they really mean by that is wiping out the border. Harper, Bush, and Fox call it the Security and Prosperity Partnership. And we'll talk about that a little bit later, which really encompasses, in many ways, a lot of the things that are going on, that have been going on until this point. And I call it Goodbye Canada. And I think anybody who's looked into this will have a similar impression. It really is the absorption of Canada in many most important ways that we define ourselves as a country into the American regulatory system and the American international policy worldview as well. So what it is an incremental and systematic harmonization of Canadian and American regulations and standards relating to most aspects of Canadian activities, from the environment to immigration, to border regulations, to security issues, food and health care issues, and a number of other issues, actually too broad to go through the whole list. I'd recommend anybody who wants to look at this just go to Google and bring up the Security and Prosperity Partnership and just start taking a look at it. It really is frightening. So it's going on now, and for the most part, it's been going on below the radar of citizens in all three countries, that is Canada, U.S., and Mexico. It's based in part in the ideas of a common North American approach to the rest of the world, a common security system, and a single internal market. So deep integration proposes emerging trade and border policies with the U.S., basically erasing the border, synchronizing safety and inspection programs with the U.S. And by the way, when I say that erasing the border, this isn't hyperbole. They actually say this. You think some of the commentators on this and some of the reports that come out actually talk about erasing the border. So synchronizing our regulatory system. There's something going on right now where the bureaucrats in both the United States and Canada, I'm not sure about Mexico, are looking at a policy called test it once policy. And what that means is that for a lot of the things that we test here in Canada and they test in the United States, instead of doing it twice, we would only do it once. And when they talk about this publicly, what they talk about is things like, well, you know, they sell Cheese Whiz here in Canada, and in order to have it called cheese in Canada, you have to have 50% cheese, and in the United States, 45%, or the other way around. And they say, so when they're promoting this idea, they say, how ridiculous is that? Let's just all have the same regulation, and we all call whatever it is cheese at a certain percentage of cheese in the product. And anybody hearing that would say, well, yeah, doesn't seem too bad. But what they don't talk about are the whole range of issues around health, around environment, around food products, where we have a distinctly different view of what's healthy or what's optimal than the Americans do. One of those things would have been bovine growth hormone, which they allowed in the States and which we didn't allow here. And there's a whole range of other things where we've just taken a different approach. Once this is brought in, that's gone. And for the most part, what it means is not amalgamating ours and their systems. It's adopting their system. So that's one of the areas they're looking at. Of course, emerging our regulatory system is of great interest to the business community, because we're talking about merging with the United States, which is in under the Bush administration, is in a massive deregulatory mode. In the 206 budget of the Bush administration, they proposed to slash government programs, and these included programs to test bioengineered food, safety, forest, energy and conservation programs, flood prevention programs, funds for studies in advanced technologies, workers' job retraining, vocational rehabilitation, adult education, child medical services, education of migrant workers, protection of national parks, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Cuts are also slated to programs for watershed and rehabilitation, environmental quality controls, and research into non-fossil fuels alternatives. One American comment concluded that the Bush administration intends to drown government. And so when you hear these guys talking about the need to work more closely, and this is mostly the people in the business community, work more closely with the American government, this is one of the things they're talking about. This is one of the things they go home and have sexual fantasies about, is that they can have this kind of regime here in Canada, speeding up of deregulation. And God knows it gets bad enough here sometimes. So who's proposing this? Big business corporations, right-wing think tanks like the C.D. Howe Institute and the Fraser Institute, corporate lobby groups, some federal political parties. Deeper integration began under the Liberals and continues under the Conservatives. Why? Because both parties are heavily influenced by business. One of the things that is shocking, many of you probably know, it happened with free trade and with NAFTA, is that a lot of the provisions under NAFTA, and indeed a lot of the provisions under the WTO, were actually written by business groups, by business lobby groups, by business corporate groups, and they come and they present these suggestions to government, and they come out almost word for word in the final documents, in the final regulatory systems. Well, this has happened also under the Security and Prosperity and Partnership initiatives. You see, the Fraser Institute came out with it, they called it the Security and Prosperity Initiative. So they changed it. They changed initiative to partnership, which I guess must sound better, but it was almost word for word the document that they were presented to by the institute. So why are they proposing it? One point is, of course, from the business community is the regulatory advantages, but also after 9/11, business became very nervous. Canadian business became very nervous because they started going around the states saying security trumps trade. And so they began to, with Canada in the last, I mean, we've always had a large portion of our trade with the that goes to the U.S., but it's increased dramatically in the last 20 years. And so with, 85% of our trade, 85% plus of our trade, 90% of the value of our trade going to the United States, they began to worry that they'd be shut out of the American market. And so they began to look around for ways to ensure access to that market. You might think it's a little strange given the softwood lumber deal when we were supposed to be assured access to the American market through NAFTA, and it didn't happen. And when their interests were involved, we saw how quickly that access gets shut off. But strangely enough, they believe they can do it again. They want to take another run at it. If we can get down low enough, agree to do everything they could possibly ask us to do, maybe they will someday give us access to the market. And if they don't, well, we'll just become Americans. And then they can't shut us out, because that's where they're going. So there's solutions that we're proposing, is, you know, to merge trade, border, and regulatory systems and develop a North American security perimeter. There's an added benefit to all of this, of course, that also opens up Canadian companies to contracts for American weapon systems and so forth. So they're hoping by being the good partner that we'll also get in on the boom Trump spending in the American war machine. Of course, another issue here is that many of the Canadian businesses are American owned, so it's no great shift for them to become part of the American system. The other reason is ideological. Many of the business and governments share Americans' neoconservative worldview. Again, I find this puzzling, as many of you may, that given that this has been such a disaster, the neocon revolution has certainly hit a concrete wall, and the Americans are, in spite of their ability to cause havoc, they're really in trouble around the globe right now in many ways. Iraq has turned out to be a huge mess for them. God knows what's happening in with Israel and Lebanon, where that's going to lead them. Their economy is suffering from the huge debt burden. So why people would still cling to this as a viable way to organize economic activities is beyond me. But that's certainly, you can certainly see it in the Harper government. You can certainly, the C.D. Howe Institute and the Canadian Council of Chief Executives, they're still beating those drums. So they're interested in smaller governments, lower taxes, individual responsibility, putting the onus on individuals to look after themselves, get rid of social programs. And these are views that are regularly expressed, and you can see them almost any day in the paper by the Fraser Institute, the Ames here locally, and by politicians like Mike Harris and Preston Manning, who are now, by the way, both senior fellows of the Fraser Institute and also advisors to Steve Harper. So Harris and Manning have also called for a common customs union, mutual administration of a common tariff, a quota system to eliminate the rules of origin, and mutual responsibility for border security. Do you see anything of Canada in there, by the way? So what do we lose with deeper integration with the U.S.? Well, we've already lost a considerable amount. We're losing the ability to make our own decisions. Again, I suspect many in the audience here know of the situation with our oil. We've pretty much given it to the Americans in perpetuity under NAFTA. We've agreed to supply them with under the proportionality clause, with as much oil in the future as we're giving them now, or if we increase the proportion, we always have to keep that proportion. So even under circumstances where we might need that oil, we cannot cut back our supply to the Americans unless we cut the same amount back to ourselves. So that's one area where we've really lost control. And by the way, as far as I'm aware, we're the only country in the world with a surplus of oil who pays world price for oil. Now, there may be reasons to pay a higher price for oil, but the reason that it goes to the Americans, to my mind, is not sufficient. So control over our other natural resources like gas and water. And by the way, water is on the table in these agreements. They decided to set them aside as a topic of immediate discussion because it's too contentious. And there's one area where Canadians really react strongly when you talk about giving away control of the water. But it's there, and it's there. They're talking about it behind closed doors. They're talking about it amongst themselves. They just haven't put it on the agenda. So personal security under heightened U.S. defense policies and our social programs like public health care. And health care is under threat because under the agreements we have now, health care is protected, but it's only protected as long as it's not competing with a private sector, as long as it's publicly delivered, health care. And of course, we're in the mode right now and across the country of trying to privatize a lot of our health care system. And when that's done, when those protected services are suddenly started being delivered publicly, as they are already in some places, then it opens it up to the American healthcare corporations, conglomerates, to start coming into Canada and demanding equal treatment with Canadian companies. So how is deep integration happening? In 2005, Paul Martin, George W. Bush, and Fox signed the Security and Prosperity Partnership of North America. These meetings are continuing with Harper, taking Martin's place at the table, and the next one is scheduled for the spring of 2007, and they just had one a couple of months ago. The North American, under that, they've set up the North American Competitive Council. Cross-border working groups have been already set up to work out the details, and recommendations have come forward on how these countries should integrate. There should be a report coming out soon on that second meeting from Harper and Fox and Bush within the next month or so. I expect we'll see something. One thing that did come out is that there was a note, a brief mention of normalizing visa applications for Canada, the U.S., and Mexico in common countries of origin where visas will not be required. And I'm assuming that also means, because that was one of the ideas, was common countries where we would require visas from those countries in order for the people to enter Canada. Now, this would mean that a lot of countries that where people could traditionally, like Commonwealth countries, where people could traditionally enter Canada without those visas, they will now be required to them. And they will be required because the Americans want it this way. This is for their security. I'll just read you something. So this is from an American publication. In fact, it was a conservative publication I came across when I was looking at this. With virtually no mention in the mainstream media, Commerce Secretary Carlos M. Guterres convened on June 15th the first meeting of the North American Competitive Council, NACC, an apparently extra-constitutional advisory group organized by the Department of Commerce under the auspices of the Security and Prosperity Partnership. The NACC membership consists of 10 high-level business leaders from Mexico, Canada, and the United States. They also had a quote further on, or a comment further on, that they could find no law or regulation in the United States under which this was done. And of course, this council is also includes Canadians and Mexicans. And as far as I know, there's no law in Canada under which it's been done either. And most people don't know it's been done, and most people don't know what's going on. So these are people in the business community who are, again, going to be advising the government on how they think it's best to work together with the Americans, with no public involvement, with no legislative involvement. I just want to quickly mention some of the working groups that have already been set up under this. These are groups to look at these issues: manufactured goods and sectoral and regional competitiveness, movement of goods, energy, environment, e-commerce and information communication technology, financial services, business facilitation, food and agriculture, transportation and health. So I'll stop here now with a few pages left. You might be thankful. Just to say that this is the context in which Atlantica was happening. This is what it fit into, and there are plans for them to have similar initiatives across the country that haven't developed as far as they have here, but that certainly is the intent, to have these regional organizations go across the country. One of the things that we're hoping to do is to make, through meetings like this, through the events in St. John last month, is to make this a public issue, to allow Canadians to become aware that this is actually going on and to have a debate about it. We had a huge debate in this country over NAFTA, one that was actually won, that is, more people voted against it than voted for it. Because of the electoral system, it went through. But there has been nothing about this, nothing at all. And this is one of the big challenges ahead of us, is to make this a public issue. Thank you.
That was Cliff White at the Council of Canadians, speaking at Resisting Atlantica at the Spring Garden Memorial Library in Halifax. Next, you'll hear from Gary Leach, a political science professor from Cape Breton University.
Cliff painted the big picture for all of us tonight on what's going on the national level between Canada and the U.S. and Mexico. And as Cliff mentioned at the end, the Atlantica Initiative is the regional component of that in this area, and as Cliff said, there's similar regional components being organized across the entire border from the Atlantic to the Pacific. But one of the big, there's two big questions for me in the Atlantica Initiative. Number one is, what are the pros and cons of closer economic ties with the northeastern United States for Atlantic Canada? And number two is, which is perhaps the biggest question of all, and Cliff alluded to this, is who gets to decide if Atlantic Canada should or should not develop closer economic ties with northeastern U.S.? According to the Atlantica Initiative, the proponents of the Atlantica Initiative, the only ones who get to decide this are business leaders, corporate CEOs, and our political leaders, in much the same way as the Security and Prosperity Partnership that Cliff was talking about is taking place on the international level. The same process is happening regionally here. Last month in St. John, the conference to organize the implementation of Atlantica was only attended by corporate CEOs. The only speakers there were corporate CEOs and local politicians. No one from civil society or any other sector of society was invited to participate and speak and give an opinion on the implementation of Atlantica. No one from religious groups, from environmental groups, from labor groups, from community groups. Nobody. So clearly, you know, this is a huge question. Who gets to decide this? Atlantica is being discussed and implemented in a very undemocratic manner. We don't have any voice in it. And that is the way that the proponents of Atlantica are trying to keep it and trying to go ahead with it. They don't want us to have a voice in it. And that is the point of this meeting and other meetings and everything else we're trying to do here, is we need to make it clear, especially to our political leaders, that we should have a voice in this. Because big business automatically assumes that what is good for business is good for society as a whole. And that is not always true. And it's more than just business. In the Atlantica proponents keep talking about this. Well, this is just trade. It's just business. It's just economics. But it's more than that. The policies that they're advocating, which is an intensification of NAFTA, as Cliff alluded to, will affect our environment, our ability to determine our own environmental policies, our own labor policies, our own regulations in every area, our own social policies. They're all affected by Atlantica. So it's not just trade and the economic interests of big business. It's the lives and the quality of life of this whole region. So we all should have a voice in this process. And that's a huge issue. And as Cliff said, there was a big debate over NAFTA. And Atlantica is an intensification of NAFTA on the provincial level, between provincial governments and state governments in the U.S., in the northeastern U.S., and, you know, as we've learned from NAFTA, the free trade model leads to job insecurity, lower wages, particularly for blue-collar workers, and it's basically resulted in a global economy, contributed to a global economy of a well-paid core workforce and a large contingent, flexible, temporary workforce without job security, low wages, few benefits. Now, in studies that have been done about the effects of NAFTA in Atlantic Canada, and especially Nova Scotia, let's talk Nova Scotia here, since the implementation of the U.S.-Canadian Free Trade Agreement in 1989, which was then expanded in 1994 into NAFTA, only the 20% wealthiest income earners in Nova Scotia have seen their disposable income increase. The other 80% of Nova Scotians have seen their disposable income decrease. The poorest 20% have seen it decrease the most dramatically. That is what has happened under NAFTA, under free trade. And we've seen it, you know. I've lived in Cape Breton now the last 2 years. The mines have closed. The steel mills have closed. They offered decent paying, livable wages to people who got out of high school, to earn a living, to raise a family. Now, your option in Cape Breton when you get out of high school? You can't make a living wage. Your option is call centers. Call centers are a direct result of NAFTA. You're going to make $9 an hour, non-unionized, with very few benefits, and no job security, because when the contract's up with whatever company the call center is working for, you could be out on the street. Now, this is all directly a result of NAFTA and free trade, and Atlantica wants to intensify this process that has hurt the majority of Nova Scotians over the last 15 years. I want to take it one step beyond that. It's not just NAFTA. It's the whole global economy. You know, this is the ideology at the root of the entire global economy today being pushed by the U.S. administrations. And it was Clinton in the 90s, the Democrats. It's now Bush, the Republicans. The same way as in Canada, it's been the Liberals and the Conservatives. It doesn't matter. All those parties are serving the interests of big business. And this is the global economy now. And NAFTA is just one component of that, as is Atlantica. And we've already seen, again, consequences here locally. Brian Lee Crowley, president of the Atlantic Institute for Market Studies, one of the leading proponents of the Atlantic Initiative, has already said that cleaner and cheaper coal is available on world markets. Well, that's the reason our coal mines have closed. And we're now, Nova Scotia Power, which, before we even touch on the environmental problems of burning coal, 78% of our electricity comes from coal. And the majority of that coal comes from Colombia as part of the free trade global economy. Before, we couldn't get it from Colombia as cheap as we could mine it here until these free trade policies, deregulating, lowering tariffs, everything else, were implemented. As a result, we're now linked to human rights abuses in Colombia because that coal is cheap in Colombia, partly because of the massacres of communities in coal mining regions, displacement of communities in coal mining regions, and the massacre of union leaders that work in the energy sector in Colombia. And that is where we're getting our coal for electricity. That is a consequence of free trade. And as a result now, we have to think, you know, what kind of society do we want to live in? Do we want our standard of living to be maintained as a result of those kind of abuses? Or do we want to find ways to be more self-sustaining and a different type of trade that takes into account the benefits for both societies, our society and the societies that we're trading with, of the countries we're trading with? I mean, for example, just to touch on Nova Scotia Power and Colombian coal as a result of free trade. I mean, Nova Scotia Power is talking about spending hundreds of millions of dollars to refurbish its coal-fired power plants. The scrubbers and everything they talk about, how wonderful and clean they can make coal, that eliminates some of the immediate pollution that affects the immediate communities. It has zero effect on CO2, the leading greenhouse gas. Zero effect. That doesn't diminish the greenhouse gases we're producing at all. So why aren't we spending tens of millions of dollars or hundreds of millions of dollars on wind energy? I mean, we all know in Nova Scotia there's plenty of wind. It's perfect for wind energy. Why isn't the money going into that? Not only does that make us more self-sufficient, not only does it help the environment and help the global warming problem, it also removes us from links to human rights abuses that are occurring under the free trade global trading system. So, you know, that's one kind of local alternative we can look at. The other issues I'd like to touch on here is what are the problems, some of the problems with the Atlantica Initiative. How is that intensifying free trade and why is this bad for us? Well, one of the things it's calling for, and this is only the initial part. Well, number one, the Atlantica proponents, as Cliff said, are also calling for this fortress North America, this perimeter security to eradicate the border. As Ames has said, if the border cannot be made to disappear, its impact must at least be blurred. They want to eliminate that border in post-9/11 world to make the U.S. And the only way the U.S. is going to be willing to do that is if we agree to secure our perimeter the same way the U.S. is. That means becoming more intensely engaged in NORAD. Even more troubling, that will inevitably lead us to being engaged in the ballistic missile defense system that the Bush administration is talking about, which most Canadians don't want any part of. But that we will have to if we become deeper integrated. So there's the security questions. But more specifically to this region, let's look at Halifax. What the proponents of the Atlantic Initiative are calling for is an expansion of the port of Halifax to allow it to handle the new supersized cargo ships, ones that are too big to go through the Panama Canal. Now, they say this will create jobs and boost the local economy. Well, it may create a few jobs in the port, but ports are heavily mechanized now. It's not going to create a lot of jobs. What is it going to create? Well, these ships are so big, these container ships, that if you unloaded half of the containers on one of these ships onto trains and the other half onto trucks, just the half of a shipload that you put on trucks would require a line of tractor trailers for 32 kilometers lining up to unload half the containers on one of these ships. And again, that's not hyperbole. That statistic was spoken by Brian Lee Crowley of the Atlantic Institute for Market Studies, bragging about how these ships could boost our economy. That's their statistic. Now, to the Ames people and the proponents of Atlantic Initiative, this is great economic activity. You know, this is a lot of trade coming into our port, create a few jobs at the port, but a lot of truck driving jobs, 32 kilometers worth of tractor trailers just to unload half of one ship. We're talking thousands of truck driving jobs. Truck driving jobs in Canada aren't bad jobs. Most of them are unionized under the Teamsters, decent pay, benefits. But that's not what the Atlantica people have in mind. No, they don't want to get Nova Scotia high school graduates and teach them how to drive tractor trailers to give them a decent paying jobs instead of having to work for $9 an hour in a call center. They have a different solution for that. Again, in the words of Brian Lee Crowley, the leading advocate of Atlantica, he said the answer to filling all these jobs isn't going into high schools and talking about the great opportunities in the trucking industry here in Nova Scotia. Mexico is one of the three NAFTA partners. The answer is to set up a guest worker program. So the jobs that they are going to create in this region, they're advocating we bring in immigrants from Mexico who you know won't have the same rights as Canadian workers and won't unionize, be afraid to unionize for fear of losing their guest worker permits. So, you know, what jobs are going to be created aren't benefiting Atlantic Canadians. What do we get out of it? Well, I don't know if any of you have ever been on Highway 401 between Toronto and Windsor. My mother lives in Windsor, and that city is just buried under truck traffic. The pollution, the noise, it's horrendous. That's a major free trade corridor. That's what they want to turn our province and New Brunswick into. They want these ships to come into Halifax. They want to expand our highways through rural Nova Scotia, rural New Brunswick, so they can get to cities across northern United States. So what we're going to have is all the noise pollution, the air pollution, and all these rural communities in Nova Scotia and New Brunswick are going to watch this new economy literally pass them by. It's not going to do anything for local communities. It's not going to provide any employment. It's just going to give them noise and air pollution. So, and that is the big selling point they have for Atlantica right now. That's what they keep pitching. But we're going to get all the negative effects of it. So I want to move on in what time I got left and look at what a possible alternative. Because again, as in NAFTA, as critics of free trade have been doing for 15 years, we keep criticizing it. We need to put forward the alternatives. And there are alternatives, especially nowadays. I mean, we can see it even on just a local level. Fair trade things that are going on. Just Us Coffee here in Nova Scotia, where, you know, Mexican coffee growers get a fair wage, rather about $1.26 a pound for beans, where the market rate is about 86 cents a pound, which they can't survive on. So there's fair trade agreements going on, and these are rooted in community-to-community trade rather than business-to-business or corporation-to-corporation. You know, it benefits our community. We get organic coffee that isn't related to exploitation. The communities in southern Mexico get a living wage. It's community-to-community trade that benefits both ends. But we need to look at even beyond that, though. Well, these things are all good examples, and they're making a difference. We need to look beyond that. We need to start looking at the national level, because this is what the free traders are doing. And we need to look at society-to-society trade. Again, not corporation-to-corporation, society-to-society where both societies benefit. And we've now got examples to look at where this is happening. If we look at Venezuela and Bolivia in South America, both their leaders, Hugo Chavez and Evo Morales, have been elected because of their anti-free trade stance. Hugo Chavez in Venezuela has proposed ALBA. It's a trade alternative to the free trade area of the Americas. And the philosophy underlying ALBA contrasts sharply with the free trade doctrine at the root of NAFTA and the free trade area of the Americas. Instead of creating the conditions that allow corporations to maximize their profits with little concern as to whether or not society as a whole benefits, ALBA instead focuses on society-to-society trade. One example of this is Venezuela, as most of you probably know, has the world's largest oil reserves outside of the Middle East. Incredibly rich oil country. Has an abundance of oil. What it hasn't had under the free trade era, before Chavez came to power, was decent social programs. 70% of Venezuelans lived in poverty when Chavez came to power. The huge majority of those had no access to health care at all. Cuba, it's desperate for energy. It has virtually no energy resources, and it needs energy to run its infrastructure. What it has a surplus of is doctors and medical technicians. It has a fantastic medical school program and produces a surplus of doctors. So those two countries got together, and the governments looked at each other. Okay, what is our society producing that could benefit your society? What's your society producing that can benefit our society? And lo and behold, what they have is a trade going where there's 20,000 Cuban doctors now providing free medical care to poor Venezuelans, many of them for the first time in their lives receiving medical care, while Cuba is getting discounted oil to continue, you know, the country's infrastructure running. You know, both societies are benefiting from this. And, you know, these are the kind of examples, you know, we need to start looking for because they're happening now. 10 years ago, when we were criticizing free trade, it's like it was hard for us to point to alternatives and say, well, there are alternatives out there. That was hard 10 years ago. It's not hard now. It's happening down in South America. And another example is Evo Morales, Bolivia's new president. He just announced a few days ago the People's Trade Treaty. And it's a trade treaty between Bolivia, Venezuela, and Cuba. It's going to become a part of ALBA, Venezuela's alternative, which ALBA is also including Uruguay, Argentina, and Brazil. So we've got more and more countries getting engaged in an alternative type of trade that isn't rooted in deregulation, free markets, creating conditions for corporations to conduct trade. Again, the trade from society to society. Evo Morales' People's Trade Treaty, you know, it seeks, quote, let me quote this, the strengthening of small producers, micro-industries, cooperatives, and community-based companies. This is the exact opposite of what free trade is producing. All of those things, small producers, micro-industries, cooperative, and community-based companies in the free trade economy are being overwhelmed by big multinational corporations whose decisions are made not only out of province, but out of country, with no concern with the welfare of the average Nova Scotian or Atlantic Canadian's welfare. They're not sitting around thinking of the welfare of the average Nova Scotian when they make their decisions. So, you know, the People's Trade Treaty is an example of getting back to locally based economic activity. This achieves two things. Number one, it gives us sovereignty over our own lives and the type of society and lifestyle we want to live. And the less we depend on trade, the less we contribute to the horrendous destruction of the environment that free trade is causing because of this massive amount of transportation that's taking place. But to the degree that we do, because we don't want to just isolate ourselves, to the degree that we do want to engage in trade, we need to decide what kind of trading system do we want to be in. Just because we're next door to the United States and currently more than 85% of our exports go to the U.S. does not mean that we have to buy in and completely commit ourselves to the U.S. ideology of trade. We can start diversifying. And I'm not saying we shouldn't trade with the U.S. at all, but we can diversify. We can start looking at alternative models, other countries that are trying to find alternatives, and decide what kind of trade do we want. Do we want to establish a system that allows corporations to trade between themselves, country to country, to serve the interests of the shareholders rather than the interests of Atlantic Canadians? Or do we want a trade that's rooted in where the decisions are made based on what is good for our society and the societies on the other end? The Atlantica Initiative is clearly seeking to further intensify the former. You know, it is seeking to entrench the model of deregulation, reducing the role of government in economic decision-making, which automatically then carries over to social policy decision-making, environmental decision-making. And that is the model that the Atlantica Initiative seeks to entrench. And as I pointed out earlier, it's a model that over the last 15 years has hurt more Atlantic Canadians than it's helped. So we have to speak out and demand that an open dialogue that includes representatives of all sectors of society take place, not just CEOs and our political leaders. That this Atlantic Initiative needs to be put on the table where representatives from every sector of society can have a voice in it. And if we all decide this is not what we want, then it's not what should be imposed on us. And in that way, if we speak out, demand that, we can ensure the implementation of an alternative economic model that serves the interests of our society and other societies, the peoples of other countries we deal with, rather than corporations. Thank you.
That was Gary Leach of Cape Breton University speaking at Resisting Atlantica at the Spring Garden Memorial Library on July 27th in Halifax. Next up on the panel is Janet Eaton, professor at Acadia University, member of the Sierra Club of Canada, and national co-chair of the Voice of Women for Peace.
It really wasn't my job here tonight to cover the context, but I did a little bit just because it helped me to situate a little bit better as I was going through this. We did hear that it's mostly AIMS, the Atlantic Institute for Market Studies, headed by Brian Lee Crowley, that is really pushing this, particularly the concept of Atlantica. We hear it spoken of within government as well as the International Northeast Economic Region, which is one of about five regions across the country, which starts on the other side with the Pacific Northwest Economic Region, and which actually was active right after the SPP was signed, because I went online to try to find out what was going on, and I found out that they were having meetings out there, but just to get, as usual, the business sector was being invited to give their ideas to how we should transform our economies and our trade relations. So we can see that immediately that we're not invited into this dialogue at all. And it's basically AIMS that's propelled this into the limelight now. They've been working away and beavering away at this for at least 6 years. They're forging alliances with their neighbors to improve infrastructure and build the contacts that will allow us to combat together our common scourges of high unemployment, high out-migration, and low incomes. Like others here, I went through the website and read through quite a few of the documents there, and they're very repetitive because there's actually not much there as a core other than that continual repetition, you know, that we have to improve our infrastructure and we have to increase our trade and we have to be this big gateway analysis. What are they saying? They're making the rationale for making Halifax Container Port the gateway for North America in this whole new emerging global shipping routes, and what they call the post-Panamax vessels. And one it struggles to get a sense of how big these post-Panamax vessels are, and I thank Gary for giving us some idea of just how huge they are. It's like putting all your eggs in one basket. What a target, you know. I mean, that seems like a ludicrous idea. But anyway, so that's a little bit more on the on AIMS and on Atlantica and who's really pushing it. And as both Cliff and Gary have so well outlined for us, it's a subset of of an overarching free trade world, a global economy that is pushing a set of, disciplines. I wouldn't even call them principles, but a set of disciplines as to run the world. And so I guess the largest frame here would be the corporate economic globalization, then NAFTA, and then this SPP is, it isn't exactly totally linked to NAFTA, but it's sort of a subset of NAFTA, and Atlantica certainly falls within that. And we know what the global corporate economy, economic model is based on, And we know that all of the major structures are flawed and failing. These are just some of the attributes and characteristics of that corporate economic model, many of which we've heard about here tonight. And later on, I'm going to be talking about some of the principles for alternative economies to these. And so it's worth just looking and remembering some of these and then seeing what we really need if we're going to move ahead. It's a crime that they're trying to push this thing right now. Given Nova Scotia's history and all the good examples we have in this province of community-based development, going back to Cody and so on. So this model of unlimited and unfettered growth has brought the world to the verge of collapsing systems. And I've been sort of following for a while there, about a few months ago or a year ago, there was the word collapse was everywhere. Everything seemed to be collapsing. That gives us some idea of the extent of the damage that's been done to the world. And as one of you were saying, it's hard to believe that we've got a government that's going so deep with the United States, which is now like considered a pariah of the world, and the economic model they're pushing is moving us pretty in a catastrophic direction. So we're hearing about the peak oil phenomenon, the collapse of the U.S. economy, the collapse of the American empire, of corporate globalization and climate change and ecosystems and even civilization. Our great icons, Jane Jacobs, and then Richard Wright, you know, you may have heard them on CBC, telling us it may even be too late. And we all know now that globalism has totally failed. John Ralston Saul has given us some of his wisdom about how we're in this interregnum period now, as he calls it, in his highfalutin way. But it means that the system is collapsing, as was predicted, and we've got to get on with it. But we've got to find our way to do that. We know that the American empire is just barely surviving now. Kirkpatrick Sale did an analysis of it and said that when you look at empires, there's four ways that they usually can explain the collapse: environmental degradation, economic meltdown, military overstretch, and domestic dissent and upheaval. Well, it doesn't take much to show that the United States is pretty much there, except maybe the last one, but that will probably come, I think, shortly. And then the UN Millennium Ecosystem System Assessment, with 1,300 scientists from 95 nations, you may remember this, came out a few months ago and said that 15 of 24 major ecosystems are in serious danger of collapse. And then we know what climate change is. I'm not going to go into that. We know how serious that is. It's in the news every day now. About a year and a half ago, there was still this debate, and they have to fault the media, because every time a study would come out, they'd go and drag out somebody from a bogus institute to give the opposite perspective. And at least now it seems that they've gotten on to the fact that, you know, there really is a huge issue here. But I think one of the biggest ones for us to push here in Atlantic Canada is the peak oil phenomenon, because there's no doubt now that that the predictions have come closer to the now point in time. There was a very good video from Australian Broadcasting Corporation the other day that came around. I don't know if anybody saw it, but they interviewed oil experts in that one, and they are convinced 50% of all the oil executives in a large meeting put their hands up to say they think that we've reached peak oil now. And so this has huge implications, mind you, in our capitalist system. You know, people are going to be making masses of money. A few people are off it for 10 or so years as we go into the phase of you know, the limited supplies. But, you know, if it should be obvious to any politicians that we're going to have to start working now for the change. And so if we can show just what that is. I also found out that the federal government is funding surveys right now on cross-border regions. So that ties right in with our Atlantica concept. And so they're hoping to find that we're all very similar on both sides of the border. And of course, that's just what Brian Crowley likes us to think too. But just now, let's get into the change process. And I like to think of it as systemic change and whole system change that we're going to need here, because the principles or the guidelines for this global economy are so bad, and they're so steeped in a kind of mechanistic industrial kind of mindset. which has run its course, that the, one of the good ways of thinking about change is to think about a whole system change that's based on a whole different set of principles. And when you look at Walden Bellows' formula here for deglobalization, in a way that's a little bit of a systemic change framework, because we have to look at the deconstruction. We have to still have the protests and the ways of deconstructing what's going on and bringing the public and the politicians into that awareness. But we also have to be reconstructing at the same time. So it does deserve a lot of thought as to how we do that. It's a real challenge for global civil society. And Joanna Macy, some of you may have heard of, but her Great Turning, I find, is also a useful framework. And it's somewhat similar to Bellows. She says we have to have actions to slow down the damage to Earth and its beings. We have to have the analysis of the structural causes and the creation of structural alternatives, and a shift in consciousness. And that's a huge one, because if you look at the value system of neoconservatives, you look at the value system of liberals, and then you look at the value systems of social Democrats or Greens, and then even beyond that, you get the values of more highly evolved so-called spiritual types that get into the political analysis, which want to take us in a very pure environment. But so what we're talking about here is, I think, being aware that this does require a shift in consciousness. And we really need to feel that interconnection with nature and with the environment and with people, and make sure that that comes out in our change. This is a systemic framework that I evolved a while back, unmasking the myths of corporate economic globalization. And a way to do that, I think, is demystifying the economic theory, because it's so bad, it's so easy to do that. And there's a lot of good theorists like Heilbronner, who did our Massey lectures in 93, who does that very well, showing the evidence of the failures, which is what we're doing here. We're looking at all of that. And then the alternatives emerging from the movements, which show that we're in the midst of a shift. Then there's the global mind shift. And I think through frameworks, we can really help to illuminate that. And then finally, the global transformation, where we need to look at designing new systems and what kind of public policy we need. But we have to be careful on the design side, because you see, Kelvin Ogilvie came out in the paper today, or Jim Meek came out on his behalf and told us that Kelvin has this new idea of William McDonough's cradle to grave that's going to solve all our problems. But the problem with that is, it's sort of like natural capital. You know, and it's something that big corporations can take up, and they can become greener, but it doesn't necessarily stop, you know, the growth model that we're so concerned about. So here are the principles that all of these people that contributed to this volume have suggested that we need to redesign our economic systems and I guess our trade systems too. And we need a new kind of democracy. They call it a new or a living democracy, which is sort of like our idea of participatory democracy. We need subsidiarity. We need the decisions about how we develop our resources being made at the local level, at the closest level to where those resources are. And that's what we're not seeing now. We're seeing these decisions about our natural resources in Nova Scotia, for example, being made by foreign corporations who influence our government. Ecological sustainability, common heritage, sort of like the commons, only now it's interesting. They're putting the public service sector into the commons, which I think is a really important thing for us to be on to, and certain natural resources and certain things about culture. Human rights, and that was great the way you brought that in. You know, we have to be conscious that if we get cheaper coal from somewhere, it's on the backs of people economically, but to remember it's human rights as well. And that was a very good example about Colombia. And jobs and livelihood and employment, you certainly made that really clear to us. Food security and safety. When we get on here in a minute to the peak oil, you'll see the peak oil analysts are really zeroing in on this fact that when we have a shortage of oil in the world and we can't be trucking things all over, we're going to have to be self-sufficient in growing our own food. And it's far better to be doing that. And we should be thinking about that now. We should be really pushing for organic food policies in this province. The idea came forward 10 years ago. I was on a committee when it did. But where is that idea? You know, it's not coming forth because other people, you know, with bigger mouths and louder speakers are getting the time, and we've really got to get out there and do that. Equity and precautionary principle, which goes hand in hand with sustainability. So those are the 10 principles that should set the standards for alternate economic activity. So the other thing that I find useful is that the peak oil analysts are not only warning us about peak oil and explaining what it is to us, but they're also telling us what it will be like when we get to that point. And they say, somebody like James Howard Kunstler, who, if any of you have seen The End of Suburbia, which seems to have been shown around Nova Scotia quite a bit, he says, we'll have to downscale and rescale virtually everything we do. Our lives will become profoundly local. We will have to grow more of our food closer to where we live and on a smaller scale. Right now, 80% of our foodstuffs here come in from afar. And you've all heard the quote that most food travels 2,000 miles. That's what food miles means. And in a context of peak oil, it's just ludicrous that we ever buy kiwis from New Zealand. So now this is a paper I really recommend that you read. Go when you get home and Google Picnic for the Planet. It's an address given by Jeanette Fitzsimmons, who's a Green MP in New Zealand. And it's just a dynamic analysis of what's happening with all of this stuff that I'm talking about here and what we have to do as governments to move us beyond that. And she says things like, we will send long-distance freight by rail or ship, not truck. We will no longer trade low-value goods in bulk around the world. Walmart will cease to exist. We will trade less and do more for ourselves. And we will abandon the free trade agreements and develop fair trading relationships for those products we really need. I also, No, she's a real find. We should bring her over here to speak, I think. And then the Canadian alternatives to the SPP. If you look, I followed that for a while. I was starting to write a guide to the SPP, and so I have all this research done and haven't gotten around to putting it totally together yet. But so I was putting stuff together in a file, and I found that, you know, Campbell from the Canadian Labour and from CCPA and Andrew Jackson and the Council of Canadians, I mean, a lot of good ideas that talk about how we can draw back from NAFTA and reestablish some more national controls. And you can look up Bruce Campbell's The Case Against Continental Deep Integration. I don't have time really to go through all of the ideas there now. And Andrew Jackson from the Canadian Labour Congress in one of his recent addresses. You see, there's been about six of these major conferences in Canada over the past 2 years debating what we need to do. And so there's some very good addresses that show that we want to regain more national control of economic development. And they're all saying that we really have to look at NAFTA. Everyone recognizes we need trade, but it's what kind of trade, as Gary was saying. So in addition to that, Council of Canadians are suggesting that we need a major royal commission, or maybe a people's royal commission, because, you know, when we get in trouble economically, historically we've had them. We had the McDonnell Commission, and before that we had the Commission. And they were at critical times that moved us in different directions, but the McDonnell one took us into free trade. And there's debate about whether that really should have happened. The decks were stacked in that one. It's time to sit down and design a new economy based on the realities of the resource limitations and the ethical kind of perspectives that we all want.
That was panelist Janet Eaton closing off Resisting Atlantica, a discussion of regional and global trade issues at the Spring Garden Memorial Library in Halifax on July 27th. Resisting Atlantica was organized by the Council of Canadians, the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, and the Nova Scotia Public Interest Research Group. The discussion was recorded and produced by Erica Butler and Candace Moores for CKDU 88.1 in Halifax. Thanks for listening.